Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure of again speaking with Dr. Karen O'Brien Kopp, who's a lecturer at the University of Roehampton. In addition to new books, the podcast creates space for new developments in the field, initiatives, research projects. And today we'll be speaking with Karen about a fascinating figure named Firoz Mehta, whom she is researching. And I'm sure by the end of the podcast, you will have a much clearer idea of who this individual is and the significance of this research. Karen, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure, our pleasure. Is this the third time on the podcast? Perhaps even fourth, because you've been on with a couple joint efforts, I think.
It might even be the fourth. Certainly, I've been enjoying the experience.
Indeed.
Thank you for having me a further time.
Yes. Our pleasure. This is you're scheduled for podcast number 217. So clearly, this is neither your first rodeo nor my first rodeo. Firoz Mehta, who is this?
Firoz Mehta was an Indian philosopher of religion, we might say, who gathered a sizable community of followers in South London, particularly throughout the 1970s and 1980s, although he was giving talks before this time. And he was a very interesting figure who, I would argue, played a significant role in spreading Indian ideas about spirituality in the UK, particularly from the early 1970s onwards, and also had somewhat of an influence on the early professional development of yoga teaching in the UK, because there were some, there was a group, a community of yoga teachers who picked up on some of his ideas and therefore changed the way that they practiced and talked about and disseminated ideas about yoga in Britain.
So with this particular podcast, typically I'll read a book or gain a bunch of background information, but this podcast very much is geared towards public education, insofar as I will be receiving my education about this gentleman in public on the podcast. And so you're going to teach me what there is to know about him and why he's significant in real time, and hopefully the listeners will learn a thing or two as well. So what sort of activities was he engaged in? Was he a speaker, a thinker, a writer? Was he an asana instructor? Like, what did he do?
So he gave talks on Indian religion and philosophy from his home, primarily in South London, which was a capacious Victorian house with a library. And he talked about all the systems of Indian philosophy, Vedanta, Sankhya, but he was really interested in these theosophical notions of universal religion, universal philosophy. So he actually also gave many talks on Kabbalah, on Christian ideas, on Buddhism as well as Hindu thought, on Zoroastrianism, sometimes on Taoism, And he had a particular take because his initial training was in science. So he actually was a secondary school teacher for much of his professional life. But he came from an early theosophical background. So he is one of those figures who really, whose story really spans the whole 20th century. We're going from, you know, 1902 until the 1990s when he died. And he was part of that early theosophical community in India and was part of the transmission of those ideas to the UK.
So who was his primary audience? Who's attending his talks?
Well, perhaps I could roll back from the 1970s to talk about some of the earlier contexts in which he shared ideas and was a teacher, really, because I think he spoke to different audiences at different times throughout the 20th century. He began in the 1920s and the 1930s, at a time when he was very influenced by Theosophy and Krishnamurti, to start to hold what were called kind of spiritual camps in the UK, in places such as Dorset, which is on the south coast. And he shared ideas about philosophy and religion. He developed his own system of movement and breathing, very interesting, which he called Theorhythm. And he also was very plugged into contemporary ideas about health and physical culture and diet and sunbathing and water cures and so forth. So part of that kind of early physical culture discourse in the 1920s and 30s. So, I mean, that was one audience whereby he really spoke to families. And he had a kind of a roster of some celebrity clients, including the captain of the English cricket team, including some of the leading figures in women's physical culture movement in the UK. So that was kind of one quite important, I would say, wave of influence in the 1920s and 30s. Then in the 50s and 60s, he was more connected with the Buddhist Society in London, and he began to give talks about Hindu and Buddhist thought at the Buddhist summer schools, which happened in and around southern England. So that was another kind of wave in his influence. And then I think from the 1970s and 80s, there was another shift again in which he really developed his own identity, his own community, which we could call the Firoz Mehta community. So there were overlaps with people who adhered to the teachings of Krishnamurti or people who were connected to the Buddhist Society, but there was a core group of what we might call followers or students of Firoz Mehta. Within that, he was really committed to theosophical ideas which centered on Vedanta. But as I said, he offered a quite interesting range of teachings in his talks, so that he never just settled on one particular tradition. His audience were people who were already plugged into some of these spiritual discourses from Asia, who perhaps were already investigating Buddhism. Primarily, I would say, white English class, English middle class audiences. Interestingly, you know, I think he really built his core following around his home, which he called Dil Kusha, in the 1970s. But it was a very different type of community to what we might imagine in terms of the countercultural movement or the hippie movement of the 1970s, which is much more socially radical. So this was quite a conservative, formal type of gathering. Firoz Mehta was always dressed in a suit, a formal suit. He was very dapper. When people came to his house, the talks were always preceded by tea and cake and this kind of mingling, and then people would proceed upstairs to the talk. So some of the people that I interviewed who are the members of that early community talked about this quiet formality. And so they remembered other spiritual gatherings of the time in the 1970s, where the energy was much more effusive and people were embracing each other. And that didn't happen at the Firoz Mehta gatherings. It was very understated. You might shake hands with Feroz, perhaps not, but certainly there was, you know, it wasn't really the typical kind of flower power hippie mood of the 1970s that we might expect. It was something quite different, quite formal, quite scholarly. But it was it resulted in a community or a group who were not only loyal to Feroz Mehta, but had bonds with each other which have endured up until the present day.
So Indian spirituality with a bit of a stiffer upper lip, perhaps.
I mean, we have to recall that Feroz Mehta was born in 1902 in India. He grew up as a young man in Sri Lanka. But he would have been in his 70s by the time that he actually really started branching out with his own teachings during the 1970s. So he was already at a quite advanced stage in life. And I think that reflects some of the conservative values that we see in this particular group.
So you've touched on this, but to what would you attribute his appeal? Why were people coming to him rather than other thinkers or movements at the time?
Well, this is a really interesting question. And so perhaps here I could introduce my research project, which has been generously funded by the Southlands Methodist Trust at the University of Roehampton. And this has involved qualitative research whereby I've interviewed some of the surviving members of those early attendees. Sadly, other individuals whom I would have liked to have interviewed have since passed away. But they speak about him as being a person of integrity, of truth. They felt that when they attended the talks with him, they didn't always understand all of the philosophical ideas that he was explaining, which they sometimes found to be quite difficult to digest. He was a very scholarly writer and thinker. But all of those talks have been, well, not all of them, but many or most of them have been recorded and catalogued over the years. So his followers always had a reel-to-reel tape next to him, and they recorded many of his talks onto cassette. So those talks are recorded, and we can go back and listen to them and get a flavour of what those gatherings were like. But all of his followers spoke about what happened when the tape machine went off. So they were interested in the less rehearsed part of their time with him, where they felt that something transcendent came through him. So they were very clear, really, that there was something special, something distinguished about Feroz Mehta, which could only really be accessed by being in his presence. And although actually, I even hesitate to refer to this group as followers, because they are very hesitant to call him a teacher. They don't really regard themselves as students. They just see it as a relationship of listening and being in the presence of Feroz Mehta.
That's fascinating. How did you get into this character? How did he become an object of study for you?
Well, the surviving members ran a trust called the Feroz Mehta Trust, which looked after his personal papers and also the online archive of his talks. And I became aware of them through their connection with SOAS, University of London, where I did my graduate studies and also lectured for a while. And through some interactions there, I went to give a talk at the Feroz Mehta Summer School, perhaps in 2016 or 2017. And I met some of the surviving members and started to hear some of their stories. I also met one of the early yoga teachers from this period. And as I learned something of their stories, I realized that there was a quite interesting oral history here that, in a sense, needed to be captured, because many of these individuals are now their 80s or 90s, in some cases late 90s. And so it was important to get a sense of who this figure was and what his contribution was to ideas about spirituality and discourses about spirituality in Britain.
What would you say are some of the distinctive or unique features of his platform, of his teachings, of his angle?
Well, I think for anybody who is familiar with theosophy, that continued to underpin his teachings really throughout his life. And he had several publications. So pretty much every decade, he wrote a book. So in the 1950s, he wrote a very scholarly book called Early Indian Religious Thought, where he went back to the Vedas, and back to the Upanishads, which I think really were the guiding texts for his ideas. In the 1970s, he wrote a book called The Heart of Religion, where he argued that there is just one religion, but many paths. So as far as he was concerned, there was just really one truth, one apprehension of truth. And he saw himself as presenting that through different means, be they Zoroastrian or Kabbalistic or Taoist or Vedanta. But he also did dedicate some specific publications to particular traditions. So he wrote a book on Buddhism. He wrote a book on Zoroastrianism, for example. But the key ideas were, I think, those ideas that would be familiar to anybody who's looked into theosophy and Krishnamurti, that there is no structured path to realization, to spiritual realization, that it's an individual process, that it comes through attention to the everyday. It comes through attention to ordinary experience, and that there are no, I mean, it's quite paradoxical, but there are no gurus. There are no particular traditions that are elevated above others, for example. So, you know, I think it was a set of teachings that were, in a sense, quite historically rooted in theosophy, but resonated with these new ideas within the human potential movement in the 1970s.
Do you feel that he either overtly or covertly might have privileged Indic ideas? I mean, irrespective of his platform of universalism, right, or along the lines of, you know, the many paths to awareness or truth or consciousness or however you want to phrase it, that isn't there something implicit to his platform and training and bent that prioritizes Indic ideas, or would you say not necessarily?
Well, I mean, this is the paradox. He absolutely did prioritize Indic ideas, and he himself, if we look at the main topics that he revisited time and time again, he was really talking about Vedanta, Brahman and Atman. He was really drawing on the Upanishads extensively. But he brought them into a deep conversation with Buddhist ideas. So those were the two traditions that he explored most, discussed most in his talks, and published on most extensively. But I think he also had a way of presenting these ideas in a way that was quite decontextualized. So he presented them as these ideas that could be universally accessed and were universally available to everyone. Again, a key idea in theosophy. So, you know, the extent to which his followers, I suppose, really delved into the specifics of the philosophy, I think, in the Indian traditions was probably quite limited.
So would you say that his following was not necessarily primarily interested in Indian spirituality? Or would you say that they were, and that's why they were drawn to him?
Well, I mean, this is a question that I posed directly to all of the interviewees, which were, I managed to interview, I think it was 10 people in the end. So quite a small group who are now left, who studied with him in the early 70s. And the answers varied. On the one hand, they fully acknowledged that, you know, they were very aware of his identity as a Zoroastrian teacher, as, you know, an Indian teacher of philosophy and religion. But on the other hand, many of them never traveled to Asia or didn't extensively investigate the culture and history of India. Others did, and they were perhaps exceptional in that regard, in that they, you know, there were stories of people growing up in the 1950s and 60s with questions that they felt that traditions like Christianity couldn't answer. So they've been exploring or searching for answers in, for example, Buddhist traditions since the 1960s, and then they discovered Metta in the 70s. So I think there was a kind of a mix there of kind of ways in which his followers really actually related to India.
Can't tell you how many times I've heard words along those lines, along the lines of seeking in ways from people of Christian origin, where, you know, I couldn't find the answers in Christianity. I've heard that so many times at my own school of Indian wisdom, which, I mean, this is what, about a half a century later than the time, you know.
Yeah.
Then the time, and there still seems to be this perennial quest for meaning, and whether misguidedly or wisely, folks turning to quote unquote the East or quote unquote India for spiritual ideas. I find that utterly fascinating, not just in participating in it, but also understanding these trends. A couple of questions. I have two lines of questions. I'm trying to think of which one. Okay. Why would you say, what's the significance of this figure? What does he tell us about larger trends within Indian religions or within that time period?
Well, I think this goes back to your point about Christianity, because it's interesting, from the group that I interviewed, they were all born into a Christian tradition of one sort or another. And actually many were born into Catholicism specifically. And they sometimes describe themselves with these quite synthetic or syncretic labels, such as I am now a Buddhist Catholic, for example. So they kind of adapted and reshaped existing traditions to be more accommodating to these new ideas that they encountered with Metta. But I think in a sense, this group, which actually was quite a large group, he would have had groups of up to 30 people in his library for more than 25 years. He taught extensively at all kinds of summer schools and summer camps in the UK. He also traveled to Germany with a group annually. So he did reach a lot of people over the decades. And I think this is an early expression in the 1970s of what we now call spiritual but not religious communities. So I think that's one of his contributions to, in a sense, providing a space for people to explore and express those emerging identities, where people are, in a sense, rejecting institutional religion that they've grown up with. And as you say, they are looking for some kind of different sets of answers to the kind of existential problems that they're encountering. I mean, that was one, I think, quite major contribution. And I mean, if I may say that he had a particular relationship with a figure in the early 1970s, an author called Fritjof Capra, who went on to write a best-selling book called The Tao of Physics, which combined these quote-unquote Eastern mystical ideas. This is how they were referred to in the 70s, but essentially Indian religion and philosophy primarily, as well as Chinese religion and philosophy, with contemporary scientific ideas. And that was a very influential book for the beginnings of new religious movements, or the New Age movement, early spiritual but not religious communities. And Fritjof Capra had 2 years of one-to-one meetings with Feroz Mehta. And he acknowledges this. He says, I didn't know much about Indian philosophical ideas before I met Feroz, but I had this one-to-one relationship with him, which then was channeled into this best-selling book. So that's another way in which I think Feroz Mehta has had a somewhat invisible impact on the kind of increase in new religious movements and the whole New Age movement at the end of the 1970s.
Can you say a bit more? Sorry, go on.
Well, and I would just say that we can talk about it separately, but I think he's had another important impact, as I mentioned, on the kind of nascent professionalization of yoga teaching in the UK and some of the ways in which his ideas were incorporated into yoga classes, really, some of the changes that happened there. So I think those probably are what I would identify at the moment as the three major ways in which his influence was felt, because his books, I don't think ever really sold very widely, partly because they weren't really presented in a very popular style. I mean, his first book, Early Indian Religions or Early Indian Religious Thought, has lots of primary source passages translated from Sanskrit and Pali, from the Buddhist canon, from the early Sanskrit canons. So those are not books that necessarily, cross over easily into mass appeal, mass success.
Could you say a bit more about his role as a Zoroastrian teacher that you touched on in passing?
So he was born into a Zoroastrian family in Gujarat. His father's work then meant that the family moved to Sri Lanka. So he was raised, very traditionally within the Zoroastrian faith. But his mother was also a committed theosophist, and she would travel to Chennai to take part in the theosophical meetings with Annie Besant. So he had this concurrent influence in his childhood religiosity that was both Zoroastrian and theosophist. So I think when he came to the UK, I think in some ways, and he was extremely successful professionally. I should say that when he was 18, he won two academic scholarships in the UK. One was at the Royal College of Music to train as a concert pianist, and the other was at Cambridge to study history and natural science, or history and science. But I think that when he did arrive in the UK and he studied at Cambridge, eventually he opted for the degree in history and science, he somewhat minimized his own Zoroastrian or Parsi identity. And I would say that in the talks that he delivered from the 1950s until the 1990s, he foregrounded his own interest in Buddhism and Hindu Vedanta much more than he ever did his knowledge about Zoroastrianism. And although he wrote a book on Zarathustra in the 1980s, he published that, and he gave quite a substantial number of talks on Zoroastrianism as part of this Feroz Mehta community, he never really foregrounded it as central to the message, I think, that he was teaching. And interestingly, when I interviewed his followers, they were relatively well-versed in the other traditions that he taught about. Many of them picked up Kabbalah or Vedanta and really explored that in more depth, including after his death. But the kind of contact and engagement with Zoroastrianism was definitely less evident.
Do you, if you had to offer some conjecture, do you feel that he ran with, the sort of Hindu or Indic aspect of his training as a function of what most resonated with him, or as a function of what was more marketable at the time?
Well, I think it's a balance of both of those factors. It's partly what he was interested in, because he was very much committed to theosophical ideas that engage with Buddhist and Vedantic thought. I think he was also speaking to what his audience were interested in. He was quite clear that he wasn't marketing anything. And this is something that his followers have been very keen to alert
I just have to quickly quip that he was marketing that he wasn't marketing anything. That was his marketing message.
Right. And this was part of the kind of discursive strategy of other figures like Krishnamurti, who was hugely influential, he wasn't a teacher. It wasn't a teacher-student relationship. There was no formal structure. From a kind of historical perspective, there wasn't that much of a formal structure to what he did at home, apart from give a talk or two on a weekly basis. But his followers were quite keen to impress upon me that he never charged any money. And he said that if a teacher charged money, then there was no truth in it. The only thing that he sometimes charged for was reproducing a cassette, an audio cassette, because this is how his talks were shared between his followers and between different groups in the UK. It was all about audio cassettes. And he would charge, they said, not for the product, but for the price of the cassette. So the price of the cassette would be charged. This is an interesting point that his followers stick to quite strictly, that he wasn't a teacher and he wasn't marketing anything apart from self-inquiry.
I find it so fascinating that the very same students who went to him for his teachings would be speaking of him as not a teacher. It's a walking contradiction.
It is. And they've all corrected me on this, more or less, that they objected to any reference to him as a teacher. Now, if we actually look at the kind of discourse of Krishnamurti around the same time, Krishnamurti was very insistent also that he wasn't a teacher. Because he didn't want there to be any kind of formal structure to the relationship. But there's certainly also the suggestion that teachers like Krishnamurti and Mehta were quite resistant to being a teacher, because that really is identified with being a guru. And with that comes a great deal of responsibility for the student, which for a householder like Feroz Mehta, because that's what he was, he had a wife, he had children, he had a job he was retired certainly by the 70s, but he had other parts of his life. So he wasn't willing to take on the whole, I suppose, you know, karmic responsibility of the student in the way that relationship really does require.
This speaks to me on so many levels. I really get the sense that folks like Mehta and Krishnamurti, they're conflating, or they're using the word teacher as capital T, teacher, guru. So yeah. They don't want to be a guru. They don't want the karmic enmeshment. They don't want the pedestal. Yeah. I completely relate to that, 100%. But without question, I'm just giving an example. For example, I'm nobody's guru, at least not in my online offerings. But without question, I teach, right? Whether it's academic teaching or spiritual teaching. If one wants to go to a cooking class or a mechanic seminar, one is being taught. There's all kinds of secular instruction that's bereft of the baggage of a parampara or guru disciple relationship. And it just seems that when they use the word teacher, they mean capital T teacher. I'm not a capital T teacher, but obviously they're a teacher in the pedestrian sense.
In the pedestrian sense. But it's an interesting question as a researcher, in terms of how we present the insider voices or how we foreground emic perspectives in our research. If our interviewees are insisting that we avoid certain terms and they avoid them, then there's a question there about a responsibility to think about our own discourse as academics, or to certainly draw attention to these paradoxes perhaps in what's being talked about. But it's provided an interesting challenge for me. What other words can I use when I'm interviewing other than teacher and students, or adherent, follower, in a personal relationship? It's quite difficult actually to find other words to really describe that relationship.
I often find, just speaking with students and clients and just people in general, I often find that what they say is quite telling, but not necessarily because of the content. So they're telling us things by virtue of the content, but there's so much more that is telling about what they're prioritizing, what they're asking, what they're evading. And so what they're telling you is telling in terms of that itself is a fascinating object of research. The denial of teacherhood within a new religious movement, and sort of maybe this appealing modern idea of, well, I believe, what was it? I remember there's a Netflix special. I think on Tony Robbins, if I'm not mistaken, called "I Am Not Your Guru" or something like that. So this is a very sort of captivating idea, and people want, everyone needs mentorship or guidance or instruction, and people want that, but they also want that person to say, no, I'm not doing that. I find that to be
absolutely compelling. I mean, it's part of that quest that they each identified, that turning away from institutional religion. So it's part of the solution they're seeking, not to replace one institution with another, but to, as you say, to embrace these ideas about freedom and individualism and
quality
individual pursuit. So it's very much part of the discourse of new religious movements, certainly by the late 1970s.
Fascinating. So tell us a bit about the outputs of your research.
So the project is just wrapping up. There will be a scholarly article in a journal, but there are also several outputs that are public facing, one of which is a recording of a public talk that I gave in June at the University of Roehampton. So the recording of that will be online very soon, and there will be links to that from my research profile page on the University of Roehampton's website. Another output is intended as a public-friendly summary of the whole project. So it's a visual timeline with lots of photographs of Froese Mitter's life from the early 1910s in Sri Lanka with his family, within the bosom of his Zoroastrian family, all the way up until pretty much the last talk he gave in the early 1990s in London. So that's a really engaging visual timeline with lots of captions and audio clips and some video clips taken from the archives of the Froese Mitter Trust, but gathered in one quite succinct visual document. And we also have this wonderful podcast, of course, and there will be another it will be not so much a public-facing talk, but it will be plugging into the South London community where he lived at Dilkusha for so many years. So it will be plugging into some interreligious training workshops that are being held by the Methodist community in South London. And I'll be sharing some highlights of the research project and also some of the oral history from the interviews that I conducted.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, I so appreciate the public-facing dimension of your research. I think it's so crucial in our times. Is this a topic that you will continue to research? What's the future of this project as far as you can foresee?
Well, it's very interesting because I was very privileged not only to interview this group of members from the community, but also to be given access to Froese Mitter's personal library. So I've been doing research in his library, and I've also been given access to his scholarly archive, personal papers, lots of photographs. So although I've conceived of it as quite a small scale project, I can actually see that there is a whole larger project there that could be undertaken by myself or somebody else. but there is a question mark over whether that will in fact materialize.
Well, time will tell, as they say. And listen, all of you grad students and budding grad students out there fascinated by this figure, you now perhaps have an avenue of research. Is there anything else about this figure, his times, or the research that you'd like us to touch on before we close today?
Well, I think it links back into the previous point about outstanding research, where I feel that I might just have, touched the tip of an iceberg. But I did interview at least one surviving yoga teacher from that early period who gave me a glimpse into a kind of informal network of yoga teachers who were trained by 1970-1972 and who started to share cassette tapes of Feroz Mehta's talks, and between them started trying to shift an emphasis away from health and posture towards Indian philosophy. So they were very insistent about this, that there was a particular direction that Indian-derived yoga was pursuing in the sort of late 1960s, early 1970s, as it became embedded in local education contexts. It was really starting to be about health and fitness. And these yoga teachers were, in a sense, pushing back against that, and they wanted more instruction embedded in everyday yoga classes on philosophy and meditation and breath work, which was somewhat going against the trend for some of the more popular expressions of yoga that were developing at the time. There are some really interesting interviews where I've heard about these yoga teachers who would just play Feroz Mehta's, audio tapes, whether or not their students wanted it, and would start to develop these subgroups, so gatherings in people's front rooms where they would then invite their yoga students to come and listen to recordings of Feroz Mehta. So in a sense, there was the whole central gathering around his home at Dilkusha, but there were these little splinter or satellite groups throughout the UK where that talk was then being shared to different smaller groups. So I think that's quite an interesting dimension of his work, and I think there's some further research to be done there to really understand how influential that might have been.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure, as always. For those of you listening, once again, we've been speaking with Dr. Karen O'Brien Kopp about a fascinating figure named Feroz Mehta, a Zoroastrian teacher of Indian philosophy. Keep well until next time. Keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating these figures who've shaped our world, however visible or invisible they may be. Take care.